If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast where we delve into the intricate art of embroidery and textiles. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Alison Carpenter-Hughes, an artist celebrated for her breathtaking free-motion embroidery portraits. Alison takes us on a journey from her beginnings in machine embroidery, and we dive into the fascinating techniques that bring her work to life. We discuss the balance of accuracy and creativity in portraiture, the challenges of working with fabric, and the emotional connections behind her most memorable pieces, like Kiss Face and Little Connie, which won her the 2019 National Needle Crafter of the Year Award. If you love what you're hearing, be sure to follow Mr. X Stitch on social media, and please share this episode with a fellow needlework enthusiast. And if you feel like leaving a review, that will help the podcast reach more people, and we can share the word about textile art. We'll be back next week with the second part of our conversation with Alison. So until then, enjoy the show.
It's pretty frosty outside. Yeah, it's lovely and bright though.
Yeah, it was the same with us actually. We were sort of looking and just being, oh, it's really nice outside. And then we took the girls for a walk up to school and it was just like, we're parky. But it's, do you know what's weird though is it's like it's so nice here, and then you can see all the stuff going on in Los Angeles with like their massive fires and having any rain for 80 days or whatever it was, and it's just bonkers. Yeah. I think the world's going to pot. I thought we should just start at the start. Now, I did a bit of scrolling back through your Insta, and as far as I can tell, it was around about 2017 when you first started sharing textile-related things. Like there was a bee, I think you did. There was a textile thing. And then in 2018, in March, you did an eye. Now, was that like your first machine embroidery thing?
No. So I actually started doing machine embroidery in 2016. I joined a creative textiles workshop, well, of course, it was once a week on a Tuesday evening for a couple of hours, and I had the most amazing teacher called Anne, and she just let us do whatever we wanted to do. And I said, I'd had this kind of thought, I don't know where the influence came from, but I wanted to try machine embroidery, and she gave me a quick show how to do it, and then from there I've been self-taught. So she got me going, and then I did the bee, and I did another piece which was really twee. I still have it; it's up on my wall. But it's like a flowery piece, and I didn't feel. I think I did a butterfly as well, but they were all very, very simple pieces, and I didn't do much with it. And then in 2018, I started a residency at Studio Name in Leicester, and had a studio for free for 6 months, and an exhibition at the end of it. And I was encouraged by the directors, Steve Newker, to kind of pursue the machine embroidery element. And the first piece was my dad sleeping. It was just a close up of his head. Mm-hmm. That was my first piece. So I tried some pieces where it was more kind of free flow, just drawing, looking at a photo and doing it that way. but I wasn't getting the accuracy that I wanted. Mm-hmm. So I then drew onto the fabric and then sewed over the top of it, just very simply. But it was that kind of started, I suppose, most of my work. I'll do simple outlines and then I fill in detail by eye. So I kind of feel like I might go back and try doing it more free flow.
Yeah.
Again, because now I've got used to the machine more. I don't know. It might work. I'm not really sure. But I know there are artists out there that just go straight onto the fabric without drawing it out and do these really interesting pieces. But especially when you're doing portraits, you want some kind of accuracy, even if it's, you know, just capturing something of them. But yeah, that's where it started. And then I did my baby piece, baby breastfeeding. And then I think it was the eye. So
the baby breastfeeding was enough to secure you the title of Needlecrafter of the Year at the 2019 yeah. National Needlecrafter, just casually. I just did a baby and then I just won a national award.
Although I think I am the only one who's ever won that, because I don't think it's in existence anymore. Yeah. So
that's it. There's no point after that. They're like, no, there's no competition anymore.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And that was the second award I'd won for it, because I won the Attenborough Art Prize before that as well. So it was cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's some real validation, right? To make you feel like you're on the right path or whatever.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think... I suppose having outside validation is nice and it can lead to new opportunities as well, which is really good. And it has. I've had some amazing experiences over the last few years.
It's interesting what you were saying about the freestyle bit of it, because the person who I needle exchanged with before you was Harriet Riddle. Now she, in situ, no, she is that. She's like... freehand, just looking at people doing their portraits, almost like improv or like one of those sketch artists you see in whatever fancy capital you want to go to that does the sketch. And she's got such surety in the way she delivers her stitches. It's almost like, I remember the first time I ever saw her, I just thought it was like some kind of prodigious talent, because, you know, with free machine, isn't it, you're not moving the pen, you're moving the paper, and so it's almost like this inverse relationship that you have with drawing.
Yes, and very true. I never thought of it like that actually.
Yeah, and the way she can do it with that surety is quite impressive. But when you say about the way you do it, it makes me think sometimes of tattoo artists and how they put down the image of a tattoo and just look at the tonal areas, a bit like the way Danielle Clough does her colour blocking for her work. You know, it's about areas of tone and contrast, I think. Is that a reasonable thing to say?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and I think it's also, I'm interested in the texture and also building up layers as well. So and kind of interweaving colours. And I suppose it is like playing with paint, with the thread. It's so you kind of intermingle colors, and I think it's the detail and the color that I'm more interested in than the actual, I mean, the drawing's just a base to start on, and then it's building up through that. So I feel like it's to do with the process more than anything. I'm interested in the process of it. And that can be really painful sometimes, or a complete joy. So
let's lean into that, though. Imagine that I've never done a detailed machine embroidery portrait.
Okay.
Just tell me, I mean, so the process that you go through then, I mean, is it sort of outlining, are there basic construction principles? Say, for instance, if you were going to do a face, or let's say you were going to do a massive pair of puckering lips with some glasses, with a face that's very familiar, that is kind of epic. Like, how do you go about building that kind of piece up?
I usually start with some images of some sort, and whether that's a drawing or a photo, and then I will transfer that onto the fabric in some way, so that can work in different ways. Sometimes I draw straight onto fabric, other times I'll use a water soluble stabilizer. It depends on the quality of the fabric that I'm working on. So taking the kiss face piece, which I think you're referring to, so it was really thin fabric and a bit of a nightmare to work on, so I did do it onto water soluble stabilizer. So I drew it. I'd done the drawing, and then I drew it out onto the stabilizer, fitted it all on, and then I start to sew onto it. And it's been a learning process, because I used to outline everything. But that's one of the worst things, well, I've found, that you can do with free motion, because if you outline things and then go back to the middle, like an eye or something, or the nose, and start working outwards, you then start getting this horrible puckering happening. And you get this horrible puckering happening anyway, quite often, whatever you do. So it's not like painting. It's really... you really have to kind of work with the materials. And sometimes that can be a good thing in terms of it becoming this 3D element. So say like with my little Connie piece, the breastfeeding baby, I was able to go with the flow with that. And it became this almost 3D piece where I was able to push the piece out. And it was because it had the fibres, the more you sew, the fibres get tighter and tighter, and it starts to scrunch the fabric up as well. And I mean, I don't always use a hoop. Sometimes I use a hoop. It depends on if I feel irritated by having a hoop or not, or if it's going to mark the piece. So that's another element. It's like hoop to hoop or not to hoop. And it can depend on the fabric. So if it's something really fine, then I will hoop. And whereas a thicker fabric, it can get really difficult. And I know there's artists like Janine Heschel and Sophie. Oh, her name's gone. Textile. The one who does beautiful safari pieces. Sorry. Okay.
Sophie Standing.
No. Yes, that's it. Sophie Standing.
Yeah, right, cool.
They do these amazing thick pieces, and then they're hooping and they seem to have such wonderful flat pieces, and I'm completely in admiration of them. They have very kindly given me advice over the years where I've been like, I don't know what I'm doing with this piece, it's puckered. But so the next stage is then just starting to look at things by eye, and looking at colours and contrasts and building it up from there. So it's, and sometimes it's a case of being really playful with colour, and you won't necessarily realise it just looking at a piece, but I find it important to, if I see a colour somewhere, even if it's unexpected, I'll still put it in, because that can be the thing that enlivens a piece and makes it something pop about it. And especially when you're playing with skin tones, we've got so many colours under our skin, playing and light, and it's and you want to capture that kind of aliveness in the skin. So I sometimes find that unexpected colour can help with that. I work with straight and zigzag stitch and build up the light and dark and tone through that, and again with the colour, so it'll layer and build up and become, I suppose, the colour that you'd see in the image of the person or whatever I'm making.
So there's a couple of things I want to touch on there then. The puckering thing's interesting, isn't it? Because you have got this third dimension all of a sudden. As you said, it's not like a flat painting. So you can create depth and texture using the colour of your thread and the direction of your stitches, but then you've also got this kind of deliberacy where you can use those kind of techniques, can't you, to manipulate the fabric?
Yes. I mean, it's not always planned. In fact, I'd say more often than not. if it starts to happen, I mean, over the years, I've learned techniques where I can keep things straighter and flatter, and it's... And that quite often involves lots of layers of other things happening. It's underneath the fabric. It's not just to do with hooping or stabilizer. It can be other things. So it could be extra fabric or interfacing and things like that. It just depends on the quality of the fabric that I'm I'm using as a base. But the, so say like a Girl on Train piece, mm-hmm. which I did in Japan, there was, that was working on a really thin piece of paper. So it had to be reinforced with canvas at the back. And I did also use stabilizer, or a soluble stabilizer, which seems crazy when you're using paper, but it's it was just the only way I could get the paper to not disintegrate while I was sewing on it. And the and it started, because I was using paper and the thinness of it, it really started to warp. But actually in the end, I was able to push and the contours out of the face and shoulders, and make it look as if it was, you know, cheekbones and forehead and chin, and then go in where the neck was, and you know, and to play with that. But it was I think, I mean, I've started feeling kind of really impatient with newer pieces that I'm working on using a hoop. So I've stopped using hoop at the moment. I just find it really restrictive, so I can't move so much on the machine, and it kind of marks the fabric, and then you've got to somehow, you know, remove those marks afterwards. And it's just another kind of process that it has to go through, which can affect the material aspect of it. So yeah, so I just play.
And yeah, do you find that, like, for instance, the aspiration for a flat image goes away? Is there like a pragmatism that you learn when you're using these techniques that says, actually, I am going to get these differences in the direction of things and stuff, and there's no point fighting that? You know, I'd imagine, you know, like when you go to quilt competitions, and I think one of them, like, the criteria is how flat your quilt is, whereas and you can choose to fight that battle, can't you, or you can choose to not fight that battle. And then imagine it's different strokes of different folks in that respect.
Yes, I mean, I suppose when it comes to doing a commission piece, I want it to be as perfect as it possibly can be. I think what I find acceptable, other people might not, and they might have an expectation of how something's going to be. The other thing as well is, if you're coming to a point where you're framing something, it's a lot easier to frame something that's as flat as it can be rather than this lumpy image. So going back to Kiss Face, that's the most warped piece ever. I mean, it's like, if you actually saw the piece, I've taken some quite good photos of it, but if you saw the piece for real, it's like looking in the back of a spoon. And, or like I've got Dorian Gray mm-hmm. image up hiding in the attic. It's horrendous. It's just so everything that started to warp, I did try to emphasise in a way, so like the lips are really, really big, but they're actually kind of protruding so much, it's quite alarming. But I think going back to your question, you do have to have a bit of a laissez-faire feel to ever end up as a result, because actually it is actually really difficult when a piece isn't going quite as planned, but you feel like ripping your hair out, and you can just keep working and working on something, and actually it can get to a point where there isn't anything else you can do with it, and it can be you just have to let it go and, you know, and not drive yourself crazy. And but that again, I find, is like a learning curve. Each piece I learn something new from. I don't always remember to take it to the next piece, but I do as much as I possibly can. So
I think there's a certain surrender as well, like you said, like I've and it's quite brave. I remember talking with Ruth Norbury, and she would do pieces, machine embroidery, applique, but then after a while, she'd like just pour ink on them or something. And those are really brave things to do, because you've got no idea how it's going to turn out. But you have to be willing to take that gamble, don't you? And I guess
definitely.
It's the same with yours. You've got to, rather than keep like fighting with this thing that is not going the way that's planned, you maybe just have to go, okay, this is now a partnership agreement I have with the work.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah. And I think, going back to kind of experimentation, that's part of the fun. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to just keep churning out the same thing again and again, because and that's why I quite often work with different materials, and why I sometimes, I mean, the last few years I've been focusing on community arts rather than doing more of a personal practice, and I've learnt huge amounts through doing that and working in 3D and huge scale. And it's and although I'm now pulling back towards more my personal practice, it's the thing that keeps it alive, and just trying out things. And if they don't plan out, or you know, isn't quite right for me, then I know I can do something else. So I feel like that's a really important element of learning. And but I mean, I think also there is obviously the element there of actually pushing a part of your practice so you get good at it. And and I can look back at so you mentioned the eyepiece.
Yeah.
And I can look back at it and I can see how much my practice has come on and improved in technique. And that has, yeah, and that, and again, that's down to just learning and just practicing and just keep going at it.
Some might say it's the improvement of your craftspersonship. You know what I mean? I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's interesting how, to me, you can make that distinction. You can say the art is the story you're telling. The craft is your ability to use your tools to tell that story. Yeah. And that's what you're saying, you know, you've become much more efficient in your use of stitch direction and colour and layer and those kind of things.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think and I think also working in other areas and using different materials in different ways, it then allows me to be more innovative coming back to doing the free motion again. Being playful. I mean, you mentioned about, you know, throwing ink at a piece, and that's one of the things that I'm planning to do this year, is work more with other mediums and then bring that into the stitch. So it's just be more playful with it.
I also just wanted to ask about your use of colour, because I sometimes wonder whether there are, like, so there's a film, what is it called? I think it's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse or something. It's an animated movie.
And one of the shortcuts, I love that movie.
Yeah, and one of the shortcuts that they did is, like, when there's, like, scenes where you can see down a street, they just put blobs for the stuff in the distance. It's like a handy shortcut to, you know, and our brain just, like, writes that as we see it. And I wonder sometimes, as you're developing your use of colour in your work, whether you get those kind of shortcuts where you know that certain interventions in certain colours might achieve a result that previously you would have had to have put lots of layers on to achieve. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, fabrics, definitely. I have been playing over the last year in particular with layering very fine materials like organzas and different types of fabric where it's kind of more see-through-y and transparent and layering it up and getting quite jewel-like qualities to the piece. And gauzes and things like that. So you get different textures and kind of a shimmery effect sometimes, and and that can almost act like a layering of ink. It's really nice. So there's that aspect to it, and I've also just started kind of introducing paint elements as well, which I haven't posted anything out there yet because it's still a piece that I'm working on. But it's I kind of thought, well, actually, if I add paint at the bottom, then do I have to maybe put every single element of stitch in? I can maybe tone that back a little bit and be a little bit more sparse, which I think actually I was in when I first started my practice, and I'm kind of pulling back towards that a little bit. I want to try different ways of, putting a message across, but not working it so much. And I think sometimes that can be the case when you've been, I suppose it's like learning your practice and then paring back down again, learning from that. So I think and I want to do more with the using the different fabrics in layers as well, and pattern and actually colour in general, because I haven't actually shown completely my true self where colour's concerned, to do with the pieces that I've shown so far, because I absolutely love colour. I, in every aspect of my life, it's really, really bright. I love colour decor and colourful clothes, and it's so and like the kiss face piece, I think, was a small hint at that, because I used really not representational colours in that at all. So I want to go a bit more towards that as well and kind of play with that. Although I have got some darker pieces coming along as well. So,
but I'm glad you say that, though, because I think that that was going to be my next question, is you get this trade off. Some people, and like you and I have spoken offline about Julie Heaton, but Julie's quite faithful, I think, with her representation of colour when she's doing those kind of portraits, you know, go for the right tones and stuff. And yet you can see with Kiss Face as a good example, you've got sparks of stuff. And it makes me feel like a punk thing, but I'm not saying it's a punk thing because that goes off in the wrong direction. But you know, when you just go, I'm just going to disrupt, I'm going to use colour as a disrupted, like playful influence on the work. And it feels like those sparks are like naturally occurring things that would happen within your work. So it's interesting that you say you're going to start leaning into that more.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think I see colour almost like an aura. And I have had other artists say similar things. So, I mean, although one artist who works in 3D said they see everything in shape. So, but it's, yeah, I can be looking at an image and see something, or, you know, something out in the world, and see other layers of colour there. And it's, and I feel like if I see that, then why would I not have that in my work? So, but I think also just sometimes actually playing with colour in unexpected ways. So just one of the things I would like to work with is say taking like an example of working with red and then seeing where that goes, and just and I think having that kind of symbolism element as well, because I'm really interested in the symbolism behind things, and that might not always come across, but it's there for me. And and I suppose keeping an open narrative as well. And I think sometimes colour can add to that. So, and it can give a particular feel to a piece. And just, I mean, going back to the little Connie piece with the baby, I mean, when my niece sent me the image of breastfeeding her baby, it was in an evening tone, and it was quite yellow, and I'd gone with that. And then I had this kind of jaundiced looking baby. And I did have to draw that back quite a lot and leave it for quite a long time. So it can work sometimes and it doesn't others, but it's, but then I think just, yeah, I think sometimes also just looking at pieces where I've maybe worked with something that's from a past image. So it's sepia, or it's when I was working with things to do with sleep, I used more gentle colours because that seemed to fit the piece. So I think it just depends on the piece of work as to what kind of feel I want to give, and what I would like people to start reading into it. But then there's also that nice element where people tell you something about your work that you hadn't even realized yourself, and then it gives it a more rounded quality, and you start to understand your own work in another way.
Yeah, and it's making me think a little bit of like Andy Warhol soup cans, in as much as you can take the same image, but if you present it in different colour combinations, it definitely reads in different ways. And I guess maybe the problem you've got is you can't execute that plan very quickly with machine embroidery.
No. Being mentored at the moment by a painter.
Right.
And I said to him, I wish I was doing painting still, because that's where I started off.
Mm.
And because it just feels so much easier. It's just so much less stressful, and pain is less painful. And he said, yeah, but that's not your USP. But I think I might one day go back to painting and take the stress off, because free motion is really, it can be really, really painful. It's very labour intensive, and particularly the way I do it, I'm sure there's some people out there who don't do it as laboriously as I do, but be, and it can be really tough to work with, and it can get the especially when you're working on larger pieces or in more depth, it does get harder and harder to work on. And if you have mistakes, my God, it's almost impossible to rectify. You know, you have to find ways of dealing with that, and unpicking free motion stitches is just horrible. And I have done bits where I've had to maybe cut little elements out and rework them. So
that must be quite terrifying the first couple of times.
Oh God, yeah. And again, because Instagram has been this wonderful community, and being out, I know it does have its issues, but there is this wonderful community of people that have a huge wealth of knowledge, and they're wonderful at sharing information. So being able to have that connection with people across the world and being able to discuss things if you're having issues, and it's that has really helped sometimes. And especially when you're working on your own, and I work in a studio where there are other artists, but none of them work in the same way that I work in. So it's having that support system there, I think, is really great. And I think when, people have asked me for advice, I want to make sure that I'm able to help them in any way, because it's I think it's really important to kind of pass that on and pass the love on.
Pass the love, and maybe a stretching regime or two every now and again, just to unlock your shoulders or something.
Use a bloody hoop.
It was making me think of Jack Roberts, like JPR Stitch, and one of his techniques, which I think more people should probably try, is he goes and does it out in his garden, which I actually think is probably a really healthy thing to do in the summer, do you know what I mean? Because if you're going to be stooped over a machine, at least that way he can, like, feel the breeze on his face and all of
that's
those.
That's a really good idea. I must try that.
Yeah, all you need is an extension lead and a table, I think. It's happy days, really. So I was going to ask you about your painting, because it seems like that was what preceded your... I mean, have you done, like, formal art training, all of that? What's your backstory?
I did a degree, fine art degree in the 1990s, and then didn't really do anything of my own practice other than, little bits here and there until 2017.
Right.
So going back to the creative textile, that's kind of a course that I did. I suppose that was the first way in. But I married and had my son very soon after leaving university. So I had a great focus on that. And then I did lots of other work. So I've been a librarian and a bespoke lampshade designer and in an antique shop and Indian head massage. And I've done all kinds of different things. So interior design, very, very briefly.
Art forgery as well. I feel like you could probably slide that in somewhere and get away with it.
And done many, operations and HR and admin roles and things like that, customer care. But it's all kind of, it all adds up to where I am now. Mm-hmm. But one of the aspects I did keep going with was since about 1998, I've done creative workshops. So facilitated them and I kept that element of it going, and I love teaching. I really feel like that kind of informs my practice. But then so when I was doing my degree, that was actually with a focus on video, film and photography, and then that has changed so much over the years and I didn't keep up with it. So it's not something I'm still interested in, things like animation and stuff, which I would actually really love to try with the Stitch. I talk about laborious, but I mean...
Yeah, I was going to say, that's even the most modest cross-stitch animation takes a hell of a long time, you know?
Yeah, might be line stitch, like little moving things. But in 2017, I started doing some painting. So I was actually made redundant in 2016, and that kind of kick-started some other stuff, me being a bit more creative. And I think that's the thing, actually. I find that I have to kind of have a certain mental state going on to be creative. And I think for many years, it hadn't been great, and I didn't feel like I had that mental space. I've learned since then, actually, that you need to kind of force yourself through that, because there's been elements over the last few years where I've had that, and you have to keep pushing through it, and you just have to get yourself going again. And actually, by forcing yourself, you then start to be creative again. But at this point, I had a little bit more mental freedom going on, and not so much going on. And so I started doing the painting, and I was doing some local exhibitions and things like that. And then that's when I saw, in summer of 2017, I saw the residency at Studio Name being advertised, and I just went for it. I mean, it was a blind application, which I think actually is really good, and I think they should do in far more application processes. It's just somebody writing an application and talking about what we want to do. And I did that, and I got through to the interview stage. And I had like a week so I'd been like blah 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 in the application, and then interview, and it's like, oh, this will be this date. And I was like, oh my god, I've got like a week to get some work together. So I did a lot of drawing, and then sent it over to them, and had the interview, and then I got the residency. So it was, and I did do some painting on the residency and drawing. I love working in charcoal and pastels and kind of integrating the two, but with charcoal, it's just so lovely. And that's where it kind of started, because with the hanging threads, using those in the free motion, because I'd started using these scraps of paper. I mean, I was only working part time at that point, and I didn't have a huge amount of money, and it was so I was using brown packaging paper, and I was making these pieces and just kind of sticking them together as the piece got bigger and bigger, and had all these rough edges and torn elements. And and then when I started doing the free motion, I started thinking about the kind of rough edges again, and that kind of organic feel to it. And actually, again, I'm coming more back more towards that in the pieces I'm going to be doing in 2025. So like with the piece I did of my dad asleep in his armchair with the books behind him and a rug, and it's the piece, and, you know, wanted this piece where it was all kind of rough edged and looking like he was kind of drifting off to sleep. And again, with the little Connie piece, that kind of organic, there's no kind of end to it. It's the shape of the baby in the piece. And I really loved working with that, and working with that kind of rough quality of the stitch. And that's where it really is lovely, where it's, you get that really textural feel to a piece. Mm. And rawness. And it was really lovely, going back to what I said before about other people informing your works, particularly with those first pieces and having my solo exhibition. It seems to really kind of talk to people in different ways. And people were, I mean, I did a big piece of my dad asleep in an armchair, and it was actually full size. And although it was, for me, it was to do with sleep, other people were connecting it with like relatives that had passed, and it being an impression of somebody being in a chair that, you know, had been. And it was, and actually people saying that to me, one of the reasons I did those pieces on my dad was because he'd, shortly before I'd started my residency, he'd had a heart attack. And it was, and then obviously there was that vulnerability there. And my dad is always falling asleep in his chair when he's reading or watching telly. So for me, it was that kind of, affectionate, tenderness that I see. That's how I see my dad, or one of the elements how I see my dad. So that kind of that came from the painting and drawing element of my work. And and I still use the charcoal. I do paint occasionally if I'm just planning something out. In fact, my more recent piece, which was a commission for Lloyds Bank, it was to do with women artists doing pieces on women employees. I did do a painting before I went onto the piece, And that was quite freeing because I hadn't done that in a while. And it was, I realised actually I was quite rusty where painting's concerned. Mm-hmm. But it's something I feel like I'm going to be going more back into, but kind of integrating the two. And but normally with charcoal, I'll do like big charcoal drawings. I suppose, one of the things I've always found difficult to control is scale.
Right.
And with charcoal, I just seem to get bigger and bigger. Mm. And then I have to pare it back in. I might have to use like a projector to get it to the right size on the fabric or a photocopy.
Like the opposite of muralism, isn't it? You're going like inverse muralism.
I seem to just have no, and I've been always been like that. I find it very difficult to be contained in a sketchbook. So I don't work in them that much.
I think it's interesting, the idea of doing a painted portrait of someone and then following up with a machine-stitched portrait, because that's like the same subject matter but two different approaches, and I wonder whether you get two different feelings off of that, because I guess painting is quite speedy by comparison.
Yes, yeah. Oh, speeding's a dream. Painting's a dream in comparison speed-wise, but and also you can go over something that you've made a mistake with really easily. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think one of the things I did with that painted piece was actually play with the colour more, which then transferred itself to the stitch. And I think when I've worked with paint before and working with pastels as well, then you can be quite playful with the colour. And it's those kind of underlying things that you see and the aura in it. I also, it's that different texture with paint as well, which I think it was interesting, like doing the hair with that piece I was just talking about. In the painting, I was playing with that, with the colour and the texture. But then when I went through to the stitch piece, there was this beautiful light in the image that I'd been sent by the sitter. And it was, her hair was just like glistening, and it was the sunlight on it. It was really, really beautiful. And I was able to capture that kind of glistening effect in with the fabric I chose. So again, actually, I mean, that piece I approached in a very different way as well, because I met her remotely online before I did the piece, and then I had some email communication with her, so I was able to build up a bit of a picture of her likes and who she was, and I hopefully that came across in the piece. So I played with the fabrics, and it's quite a graphic, bold looking piece, because she's got this stripy shirt on, and then this very bright red jacket, and then her hair, I'd used a fabric that was, it's like a I don't know what it would be called, it was like a stretchy fabric that has a kind of two-tone effect, so it shimmers depending on the light. Absolute nightmare to work with. I mean, stretchy fabric and emotion is a complete nightmare, but I was really pleased with how that worked, and also working on a sort of black background and then this kind of tropical fabric. And it's like, actually, I really like that. And again, it's another thing where I might play with it a bit more in the future. So I'm working on things like black fabric as well. It then adds something else. I don't know that. It's just playing.
You also, the thing I notice about that piece is a beautiful piece. And I think the other thing I notice is you've got that yellow square, and her body is in front of the yellow square, yet the yellow square also cuts off the top of her head, if you know what I mean. So it's like you're playing with the dimension there or something.
Yeah, I think usually, I mean, you can quite often only work with images that you've got and that you've been sent. That's one of the reasons actually why I quite often, if I'm doing a commission piece, I'll ask people to send me various images, because what they have for an idea of a finished piece isn't necessarily going to work with my style. But I also want to find a piece where I feel interested in working with that image for some reason. And if someone only, I mean, occasionally I get sent only one image and you just work with it, but it's, I don't want to work in that way in general, because it's, I want to connect in some way to who I'm working, the sitter. And that might be either through colour or some kind of form of expression or the composition in some way. And it's I quite often like pieces where they're a bit more animated, where I might be able to. I don't always use the hanging threads, so I didn't in the Lloyd's Bank piece, but the in other pieces where there's maybe movement in hands, like you know, a child playing or something, where you can then have that connection with their hand and what they're playing with, or some kind of movement that quite interests me. So, and again, it's that kind of enlivening element of a piece that the.
It's interesting as well, sorry to interrupt, it's interesting as well that you're going to spend so long on a portrait. You're not banging a portrait out in 5 minutes, so you feel like you probably have to have an understanding of the person, because otherwise you're just going to make up a story of that person because you're spending so long on it. Like, that's a naturally occurring thing, isn't it? So I guess it behooves you to get a sense of that person in the first place, so you go in the right direction.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I was quite privileged in working with the Lloyd's Bank piece that I was able to get to know quite a lot about the lady before I did an image of her. Normally you don't have that privilege. You're usually just sent an image and you have to create quite a quick understanding visually of that person and what you want to capture within the portrait. So I think going back to a piece that I did for the Framework Knitters Museum in Ruddington, that was working with two boys that had been alive in the 19th century, and they were only about, I think it was about 8 or 9 kind of age, and they worked in the Framework Knitters with them, you know, on a daily basis, so child labour. And I was sent a portrait, a group piece. So it was this massive group piece, this tiny sepia picture with these even tinier little pictures of these two little boys. And so I had to kind of, you know, zone in on their two little faces. But also what quite interests me is having, particularly when I'm doing commissions like that, is, or any piece of work, is actually having a bit of research before I start doing the work. And that helps me, again, connect with the subject matter. And so I drew some understanding of the Framework Knitters' lives, and visited the museum, which is a living museum. So, you know, get to see around the cottages they lived in and the working conditions and things like that. And, yeah, just started to really connect with these two little boys, and felt really like quite emotional when I was working on the piece. And again, what I said earlier about working on the sepia piece is you want to capture that delicacy, but it was also the delicacy of them being from the past, and the hardship of their lives, and the, I feel quite emotional about it now and because I was doing a piece to do with sleep, because they were topping and tailing in a bed, that kind of, again, that vulnerability, there's that tenderness and vulnerability of sleep. And I really wanted to capture that. And so being able to connect with them as much as I possibly could, really, I suppose, enhanced the experience, making experience for me.
Yeah, that's quite profound, isn't it? Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.